Welcome to Marissa's Wicked Word Nosh, a place to chow down on topics relevant to all kinds of writers.
Hello, and welcome to Marissa's Wicked Word Nosh. I'm Marissa, and if you're a regular listener of this podcast, first of all, thank you. But also, if you're thinking that that opening music you just heard sounded different than it normally does, you are correct. I was messing around a little last week with some of the music that's available through Anchor, who is the sponsor of this podcast. They have a wonderful library of sounds and music that we are able to use in our podcasts. And I didn't realize I saved it, but apparently I did. So I was pleasantly surprised to find it, and I kind of like it, so I think I'm going to use it for a while. I've been using the same intro music for months now, and what can I say? I believe a little change is good every now and then, you know? Anyway, I had a wonderful conversation via Zoom several nights ago with a very talented writer and performer, John Aaron Sandler. And with no further ado, I'm going to get right into the interview, which I think you're going to get a lot out of no matter what type of writing you do. And I'm also going to post links to his work in the notes for this episode, and I really hope you'll all check him out. So, enjoy. So my guest today is John Aaron Sandler, who is a writer and performer based out of Toronto. You can find all his work at johnaaronsandler.com, and I'm going to post a link to that in the notes for this episode. And John, is it John or John Aaron? Because I thought in some of the stories I heard John Aaron, the ones that...
It's usually John. I think the John Aaron, and it's spelled weird too. It's J-O-N-A-A-R-O-N, not J-O-H-N. The reason I went with that, just for the website and just for the pen name, I guess, is that Jonathan Sandler is a really good looking actor and musician on Google. Hmm. And he had the top Google hit for a while. And so I couldn't compete. So, and he had the domain name too. So I said, well, you know, I've never really done the middle name. It's my paternal grandfather's name. And John is great, but J-O-H-N obviously is very common. And there was a lot of John, and John Aaron's even, I think, a Game of Thrones character as well. Hmm. So there was like a lot of J-O-H-N Aarons out there. So once I did the J-O-N, all of a sudden, weird spelling got me the top hit on Google. So I said, okay, we're going to go with, that's my writer's name now. That's what we're doing. 2020 decisions.
That is really exciting.
Well, it's practical anyway. So I wish there was a more noble purpose.
No, I think that's fantastic. I mean, that definitely works.
Thank you.
Awesome story. So I saw on your website that you started writing it when you were 8 years old, but you decided to pursue it more while recovering from an injury. If you don't mind, would you be able to go a little more into that, like how you got into really writing during that period?
I think the injury itself was a severe knee injury. I was going up playing basketball, and when I came down, there was just this, I've been told, a very random occurrence where none of the muscles fire, and my tibial plateau, my knee was shattered, exploded, and it took about 3 years to recover. It took four surgeries, and at the same time, when I broke my knee, I broke my knee, I had just finished sort of weaning myself off of a real cocktail of psychiatric medication. I really, judging by how normal I and fairly healthy I am now, probably shouldn't have been on. And so once I'd broken my knee, going back on, you know, nerve medications and painkillers, and sort of going, still being in sort of antidepressant withdrawal, all of this stuff was, you can imagine, really difficult to do anything other than that. That this was, I think I say in one of my stories, you know, my surgeon said, this is your job now. Just moving your leg back and forth is now your job. And, you know, getting off the medication. So I also thought it was my job. So I really couldn't do anything. And then once I moved back to the city after about 3 years, I realized that like I'd lost a lot of time. I'd lost time with the injury. I'd lost time with being medicated. And I had started as a very young kid wanting to write. I thought I was pretty good at it. I did an undergrad in literature, but I never thought it was a practical thing. I never thought I could do it professionally. But all of a sudden, after all of this, I thought, well, it's the only thing I really want to do. And after having been out of the world for so long, there weren't a lot of doors open to do other things. There was, in a way, kind of no more risk. I hate to say it, but it was sort of this, this feeling of sort of last ditch or desperation of like, I need to do something to get into the world. I need to be able to connect with people. I need to maybe have some kind of profession to my name so people will deal with me. I'm tired of being in a room right, all by myself. So how are we going to do that? And that was the initial thinking. And I started to write. It wasn't very good. I was really out of practice. And then I, through a friend, I found out about these sort of storytelling groups in Toronto that meet. And I went to the first one, was called Stories We Don't Tell. And luckily, I had an interesting story from the injury and everything else. And just by working, every day on it and then going to these groups and then reading in front of people live and then going back and working the material over again, slowly, like very slowly, the writing got better and better. And after about, I would say, 2.5 years, once COVID hit, I thought, okay, now's the time to really try to get it out there. I had it on a little website. I wasn't really promoting it very heavily. I had a newsletter with my friends and family. I had a Twitter account with one robot and 12 people, two of them who were cousins. I just sort of decided, now's the time to get it out. And I don't know if I would have done that if my girlfriend who'd moved in with me when COVID hit had said, you just need to do this. Let's make some funny videos. Let's just get rid of your nervousness about putting out your stuff to the world. And she was really encouraging. And then the first couple things that we did, people were cool with them. I was, worried I was going to be embarrassed. It was me dancing with oranges and stuff like that just to get people looking at my Instagram or something. And all of a sudden people were engaging and I said, okay, let's bring them in with that and let's then sort of show them the writing. So that was really the process. It was a process of really wanting to get out of all these different isolations, get into the world, connect with people, and also create some kind of professional identity so that I, wasn't literally or metaphorically sort of alone in this room. And I think that's how that happened.
Yeah, great what you were telling me. There were a few things in there that I wanted to kind of unpack a little more. Your bio really resonated with me. I like that you addressed the vulnerability that you were feeling. You mentioned that in the bio and you mentioned it just now. I think that's something that it does affect quite a few writers, putting their stuff out there. What are some ways that you think a writer can work on getting over that or maybe becoming more comfortable with it, that even if they're not totally comfortable, being more willing to put themselves out there? Like, what are some things that worked for you that maybe might work for somebody else?
Well, I think for me personally, and I hope it translates to other people, I'm not sure. I had a concept of what it meant to be a writer, and it was very much sort of either the person up in the ivory tower, the man on the mountain, or the guy on stage, at a book festival. It was really, I write in my garret somewhere, and then I show you this book that I have written, and you take it, and then, pay attention to me, and that's what it's all about. It's a very one-way kind of thinking, and I think one of the problems with that is it made it very hard for me to accept criticism, because I wasn't bringing it to an audience. I wasn't interacting with people. So I couldn't get a sense of when maybe I thought the criticism was warranted, when it wasn't. I wasn't trying things in a relationship with an audience. And also there was this sense of, if it wasn't perfect and brilliant, I couldn't show it yet, because it was all about being perfect and brilliant.
I feel like that a lot with my stuff.
Yeah. I think it's a very common thing to feel, you know, because we only see writers at the top of their game very often, once they've done the thing, whatever it is, their great poem, their great novel, their great play, the thing that really made their name. But of course, the more I looked into it, and I've been looking more into it recently because I've been trying to understand maybe what an online community could be beyond simply that one directional promotional community or relationship. And could it be something like, you know, a French salon with a lot of artists chatting? You know, what were those like? You know, what was a Vienna coffee shop like in the 20s, right? I think what it was is people trying a lot of different stuff. A lot of it was bad. A lot of people we think are brilliant were doing stuff that wasn't very good and learning from each other, helping each other get stuff out to smaller publications, to smaller audiences. And then occasionally the person we've heard about, the person that we finally get to see, jumped out and went worldwide. But there was all of this very kind of roiling creative stuff happening before that moment, before they came up with their big thing. And so I realized that, and it happened in front of an audience, you know? And so I realized that I needed that kind of group. I needed to find that kind of audience. And I don't want to say it's a safe audience, because obviously they can really come at you and they can say, get off the stage and don't come back, right? But, you know, it's not going to go worldwide and it'd be that kind of thing. So it was really that kind of understanding of, it, you know, for me, getting the material into a real mix, into a real conversation, in front of a live audience that could speak back, into these creative groups, either online or in person, where there could be a lot of creative conversations and critical conversations. And then over time, I could think about them and sort of decide for myself what I wanted to accept or what I didn't want to accept. That was helpful. I think being injured was helpful in the sense of, you know, time's running out. It felt like that. You know, needing to connect with people was sort of very important. So I was a little desperate there. So there was a sense of, I'm just going to jump. You know, I'm just going to leap into this thing. And there is an element, I think I saw writer Laurel Brett say this on Twitter today, you know, faith fills in what we think facts should very often.
Yeah.
And so there was this element of, I really wanted to be sure I was a good enough writer to justify fully committing to putting not just the best work out there, but the stuff that I really thought would connect with people. And even, and I don't often think people need to put out their most horrible secrets. Like, I don't think it's about spectacle.
Right.
I think it's about just knowing you really tried your best at whatever it was. And the thing is, when you do that, when you take that thing and you craft it and you spend tons and tons of time and you put out this artistic vulnerability, which is, this is the best I can do, right? That's the artistic vulnerability. It may include thoughts and feelings that are very close and close to your heart, because that's often where we get our deepest creative sense. So those two things are mixed up. But I don't mean your most deep, dark secret. I just mean your most artistically vulnerable place. When we put it out there, the danger is someone is going to legitimately say it's not good enough, and that they'll be right.
Yeah.
And that moment you can never truly hedge against. You simply have to jump out into it. And it's easier when you're jumping out into it in a small community at first, where you can come back again and again and again to see, is it the fact that I don't have it, or is it the fact that I just need to refine?
Right.
And then at the same time, it helps if you just have this, you know, crazy need to do it that makes you take that jump. I think those two things, or at least that way of thinking about it, for me was very helpful. Because as I say in that bio, I do worry about being that 50-year-old actor waiting tables, completely convinced he's going to be the next leading man. Everybody can see it's not true. But you know, you can never really know if are you deluded about it or are you right. Until it happens, it's, you know, it's all right. So that's always the danger for me, and I think those two things made it something that I could try to do. Was that too long? Did that answer?
No, I think that's fantastic. Everything you said. I want to ask you a little more. Like, everything you're saying is like bringing up all these other things I want to ask you about. I hope I'm not like asking you like too many questions.
No, not at all. No, I'm here. Ask me. Whatever you like.
So I was fascinated going through your website that you've done so many performances. Like, first of all, did you have a lot of performance experience before writing? And I guess second, if you don't mind the two-part question, do you write a lot of your stuff with the purpose of reading it? Do you see them as connected?
Yeah, I really do. I had been a trained classical musician in my 20s,
right.
A classical guitarist, and I did a master's degree in it. So there was a lot of rigor there about how to prepare for a performance. So I think I did have that performance training to a certain extent. I think public speaking is different than playing music. You don't have an instrument to hide behind. You also don't have to worry about your hands shaking. So there's a bit of a, trade-off there. But I think that what I learned from the performance techniques of music was to really prepare in your mind for the performance. So I would, for example, I would write, and I would just write to get a story written. I wouldn't think of it as I'm going to read this out loud. Just write the story, whatever it is. And then I would, bring in two good friends who, God love them, allowed me to read this first draft. And I would read it for them. And even if they don't tell me anything, I could get a sense of, oh, this isn't working. They're bored. Something's lacking. It's dragging. This is just, something's wrong here. And I could be making notes afterwards or whatever. Then, just like with music performance, I would record my voice. I would listen back to how I read it. And then I would, make notes there, rewrite it. Then I would actually send the written version to friends of mine who, work in fields of story editing and stuff like that. And they were nice enough, for the first couple of stories, because I was very nervous, to just kind of take it apart technically. And they would say, the story doesn't work for whatever reason. Then I would redo it again. Then I would go to the storytelling, writers groups, where they did say you need to write it down and you need to read it from the page. And we would work on it again. And then I would rewrite it a few more times, just let it sit, come back to it, read it again, think about it, let it sit again. Usually what I find is, the moment I don't want to work on it anymore is where is all the good stuff is, and it's the last two drafts. So there's a moment where I'm like, I have worked on this. So I would do a show pretty much every month at the end of the month, or sometimes twice a month. If I did twice a month, usually I would be doing an old story sort of halfway through the month. But I would start writing at the beginning of the month, and I would perform it at the end. And usually 3 days before, I would be like, I'm done with this. I can't stand it anymore.
Yeah.
And every time when I decided to go back and just give it one or two more drafts, it was always so much better. Somehow that always just worked. And then I would go and do it in the performance, and I would notice that as I'm reading it, I could kind of feel the audience, attention wandering, and I would edit on the fly. I would just start cutting things out while I'm reading it, just because, okay, I can't, this, we don't need this, we don't need this. And then that part, it would be the final copy, and then I would re-record it or edit it for my website. So that was sort of the process of writing it. So I don't know if I thought about it purely from a speaking or a, this is meant to be read perspective.
Right.
But it somehow for me got rid of a lot of bad habits. It made me clearer and more concise in my language. It oddly enough made things, made people be able to see what I was saying better, I've been told, even though I don't describe as much, because I would have to take out very long paragraphs of exposition because it would drag. So I would need to find the right sentence or the right word to sort of point people to what I'm talking about and kind of get the image in their head. I needed the audience to do more of the work, and I wasn't confident enough before then to do that. I wanted to describe everything. I wanted to be sure that they would get exactly what I'm saying. But because in front of an audience, there's a timing thing. You've only got 12 minutes before they start to drift, for me anyway. And so I needed to cut a lot of that. I just needed that perfect or that appropriate, sentence. And that seemed to make the writing a lot better. So I think that was the process of performing, how to perform, and then how that affected the writing. Did I get to the second part of the question, or what was the?
I think you did mention it that sorry. Not necessarily writing to perform, but it, you know, performing it actually helps you in a lot of ways. I can definitely see that. I think that's a great because I love reading my stuff. I have acting experience, so I've done a lot of like community theater when I was in school, that type of thing. So I mean, I love it. I know that's something that a lot of writers are not. Like when I was going to a writing group, there were people in my writing group that weren't that comfortable reading in front of people. So what are some things that maybe when you're reading your piece in front of people, I mean, now you're, I don't know if live performances have really resumed up by you yet, or if you're still mainly doing Zoom, but like what are some things that maybe a writer who's not comfortable reading their stuff in front of a live audience, some things they can keep in mind that maybe they can work at it and improve.
Yeah, I think it's a really, I think the first thing is to be aware there probably is a technique to it, like that it's not the same as you don't necessarily, I mean, some people can, but you might not want to just go up and wing it. A couple things I would do, I mean, just little ones on YouTube is I would go and look at, it's funny you bring up acting, because I would look up like the British Royal Academy of Acting, and I would say like, how do you warm your voice up? How do you project your voice? How do you get a sense of that like confident voice? Partly because I was burning my voice out about 10 minutes in. I was just too up in my head voice. I wasn't sort of, you know, down in the chest, and I needed to get my voice down because the more nervous I got, the more my breath became shallow and the more my voice sort of kept
Right.
rising, felt like it kept rising. So I just would start losing my voice. So I would go, there's a lot of that kind of stuff, little technical things for your voice. I would say also video recording and just audio recording yourself to see, oh, am I speaking too fast? Am I making the face that I think I'm making? You know, there's that sense of being aware that you are being looked at and it being able to manage both that kind of double vision of I have to be inside myself to get out what I'm trying to get out, and I also have to be aware that I am being observed and in control of that, so it doesn't sort of get away from me or distract from what I'm trying to do. So I think though there are a lot of those kind of resources that I think are important. I think though mainly, and this is, I think it's fair to say, you know, there's nothing wrong if a writer just writes books and doesn't read their stuff. You know, no one has to be everything.
Right, I agree
So,
with
you
that.
know, like, yeah. So this is for people interested in it. You know, because I think there's something about one of those big novels you can just get lost in that doesn't necessarily read out loud, but when you're just sort of just in it, it's just this wonderful thing. So I do love that kind of art form as well. But for people who do want to be, especially now with Zoom and with social media and with any opportunity that can come along, want to be able to be reading, I think being able to get a feel for the audience and be able to react to them is very, very big. You know, just be aware that you can just edit something if something's dragging, you can start just tossing the material. You know, if it there's a way to cut something from your story or from what you're reading to sort of just keep things going, you know, that's okay. If you need to read in front of one or two people to start and work your way up over time, which is what I did, you know, and just find two people, 10 people, 20 people, you know, so that the nerves kind of calm down. That's a really good way to start getting a feel for the audience. If you know, just record yourself and then, you know, on for YouTube or something and send it to people and just get some notes, you know, this idea of how can you get input from the audience and then think about it. You don't always have to take it. Sometimes you want the audience to be uncomfortable or even bored
Right.
or whatever. Like sometimes there's certain things you want to do, but you want to get a certain control over that before you start making those decisions. You know, I was remembering the last show I told a story at, there was someone, I told one that I thought was a challenging story to read about getting off the last sort of day of being on psychiatric medication and just sort of sitting outside. It's a very slow story. I think it's worthwhile, but it wasn't a crowd pleaser. It wasn't meant to be sort of a funny story that got everybody feeling good.
Yeah.
And then there was a guy after me that did do sort of one of these funny stories, and he did it very well, but it was interesting to be on both sides of that where I said, okay, that's good. I don't want to need a laugh. I don't want to need to make the audience feel good. I want to be able to keep the audience's attention and make them go where I want them to go. And so it's developing that sense of the audience and then being able to direct it that I think in terms of beyond just nerves, beyond just technique, beyond just getting, you know, your voice set, getting warmed up with stretching or whatever it is you have to do, that sense I think is the really critical thing to always be keeping in mind when you are reading something. You know, you are now in a direct relationship with an audience.
Right. Yeah, that's good to remember. I think it's important that you said that some books are not meant to be read aloud. That's an important point. You know, there are just so many possibilities, but it's good to know that there are things writers can do if they are interested in reading in front of people to improve on that. Unfortunately, I came late, but your stories in Pierogies Night at the end of September, I thought what I saw of that was fantastic. How many of those have you done since the pandemic started? And what are some of the similarities and differences between doing performances like that in front of a live audience and in front of Zoom? Like, what are some of the benefits that each has?
Yeah, and just for anybody who's listening, so I've been doing these Zoom events, a lot of people have been. It's called Stories and Pierogies, and the reason is because on Twitter, I just talked about how we were eating so many pierogies because we couldn't really go to the grocery store, so the quickest thing we could grab were boxes of pierogies.
And then we started to get a little bit heavy,
and we're like, we have to stop eating pierogies. But by then, it was too late because it becomes sort of a popular thing on my account. And then someone said, you know, we should do something where we've got these all these writers on Twitter and Instagram together. We should do something. I'm lonely. We're all under lockdown. And I said, yeah, we should. And it just popped into my head. Stories and Pierogies was just a really funny, you know, rhyming name. And then I reached out to some writers, and we did get the first writer who was like a published writer, had her review in the New York Times books. Her name, Laurel Brett, she's on Twitter. And then we got three of the indie writers who were on, were just sort of, had come back to Twitter, you know, because of COVID. And they were all really great. And so, you know, I got a Zoom account. People supported me on my Patreon site, buy me a coffee, so I could get a little bit of, I needed a cable, I needed a pro account, all these, you know, little expenses. Going live, I did tests for a whole week with a whole bunch of different people, small groups, family and friends, just to see what worked and what broke down, and made corrections for that. So I always recommend testing all this stuff. Made sure that I had, you know, my bookshelf background set properly, so all that kind of thing. And it was a great night. So basically, what it is a established, quote unquote, you know, established published writer is with an indie writer who's either self-publishing or working on a manuscript. They both read from their work. We have a conversation about the work based on some kind of theme, you know, it could be all sorts of different things. And then people who come get to ask questions either in the chats or directly. And we threw in a pierogi competition because it was great. Called Stories and Pierogies. So your best looking pierogi got you my lovely partner H's artwork. Either be it bookmark or digital image or whatever it is, and it was really, really good. And I think that for me, the it was very similar to some of the storytelling events that I'd been to, which was, you know, you'd have a bit of food there. It would be very communal, very collegial, very democratic. You know, no one was up on a big stage. Often it was in people's living rooms that it was held, and it was just kind of a cool, fun community style event. And I really wanted to try to, you know, bring that to an online form, because I did find that some of the online stuff was very focused on, you know, all we're here to do is watch someone talk and then we all leave, you know, and it's very hard to generate that conversation. So, you know, the food helped and, you know, the open questioning helped afterwards. And so that, I like that was very nice. In terms of the performance aspect of it, it was very hard to adjust to. And I'm glad I did the small shows beforehand, because I couldn't feel the audience at all. Because to make Zoom work, and I don't know about other platforms, but I imagine it's similar, you have to turn off everybody's mic. it's just you.
So yeah.
It's all, you know what I mean? So it's almost like speaking on radio, I imagine, and you have to sort of keep in mind in your imagination that there is an audience out there, and stay very, very focused that you're being observed, even though you can't hear anything. You have to assume where the responses are going to be, where the laughs, you have to just hope that they're there or hope that the interest stays. And for me, I would keep the sort of all of the screens on Zoom. You can see everybody, or you can do just a specific, just you. And I would keep everybody's screen on who was there. And I try to watch their reactions just to see if I, you know, if I was guessing correctly. The downside, of course, is I'm recording it. So that means I'm just a tiny little square out of 40 squares. You know, it doesn't record quite as well. But it was helpful to do it in that way, just to get a good read. And so it was took a lot more concentration. And I felt I had to do a little bit more mental prep work beforehand that, you know, when I used to play guitar, what I would do is I would sort of do a stretch for about 30, 40 minutes, lie down, and I do my whole concert in my head from my perspective and then from the audience's perspective, just to sort of run through things, especially for a big pressure performance. For this, I wouldn't go that intensely, but I would sort of, you know, chill out, imagine myself, you know, speaking my story. You know, I'd be looking at the text, imagining what I looked like, just kind of going through it a little bit so that when I was actually on camera, you know, things were not throwing me, that right. I wasn't pausing or getting distracted, that I could stay focused. You know, just staying focused in a vacuum and just silence, that was very challenging. So I would say that was the biggest thing to adjust to. But it's a different kind of nervousness.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of I was just talking on the most recent episode of my podcast. I'm a fan of Caitlin Dowdy. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she does the Ask a Mortician series on YouTube, and she's written a few books about her experiences as a mortician and a crematory operator. And I saw a Zoom event that she did a few weeks back. She was going on a book tour because her book came out in paperback, but because of COVID, everything's virtual now. So she did a Zoom event, and I think they turned the mics and the cameras off and everything. And she did interact with the audience through the chat. I don't know if they're all done like that, but that's what they did for this one. But yeah, it's this bookstore in, I think, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and they have a lot of writers over the next few weeks. I think Matthew McConaughey just published a memoir or is about to, and they're going to have him, so.
Oh, man. Hey, why not, you know? All right. No, well, we did chat too. I like giving people the ability to speak to the authors directly. I really like when writers who are early in their career or who are younger writers get to speak to someone who's got published and is out there directly. I just think that's important. But that said, you know, a lot of the times I know people from my newsletter or I know them from Twitter, I get a sense that, okay, this is probably not going to be a problem. But I do respect the fact that if you're doing a big event, you know, if you have hundreds of people or something, security becomes an issue, and chat is a good way to mitigate your risk. And so that's the downside too, because if you were in a bookstore, people could come up to the mic and you could always sort of shut them down if things got a little bit weird. You could kind of tell if something was going to go a little off.
Right.
Whereas with Zoom, running a Zoom event, the stress is, how are we going to make sure everybody's, you know, following the code of conduct here and protect the authors? And so chat's very, very good for that. On average, we get about 30 to 35 attendees all over the world, which is great. Like, it's so cool to have people from Greece and Brazil,
yeah,
and all over the states. I mean, that's been a very cool part of it for me. But for the most part, it's a community that exists on social media already. We all kind of know each other. Even new people, you know them for about a week or two. It's not really strangers. And so you can have that kind of direct interaction, which I really, really like. That's something I really prize for those kind of events. But we also have chats that people who don't want to be on camera can ask questions to.
Yeah. That's great. So you have a series on your website about COVID, and I know at the event that I went to, you did your story COVID date. And I just wanted to ask you, If you could talk a little bit about what writing has been like for you during COVID, because a lot of writers have had, I guess, mixed emotions. Like some of them have seen isolation and lockdown as a good opportunity to start writing again, but others haven't really felt like writing or even reading. I've heard a lot of that. So what are some of your thoughts and what's inspired you, I guess, to write during this period?
That's a really good question. I think the one thing I definitely would want to say, and I sort of said it at the Stories and Pierogies, I have to take my own advice on this, is that if you're doing anything at this time, you know, because people, I mean, they've lost loved ones, they've lost jobs, they have a lot of insecurities, or they've just been alone for a long period of time, or they've just been with, you know, one or two other people for being, whatever it is, you know, this is a very unusual thing for humans to have to do.
Right.
To create on top of that, I think, is kind of heroic or miraculous. Maybe not heroic's the wrong word, because there's no moral value to it, but it is, you know, quite a thing. And if it's not happening, that's fine. That doesn't mean you're not a great creator. It just means that you're under more stress than the rest of us. I do believe that, you know, the writer in his or her garret is a myth. I think, in fact, people create the best when they are sort of relaxed and happy, to be honest with you. And they will take maybe experiences that were painful, but during those painful experiences, that's the thing that fills the mind. When my knee was broken, that was the only thing that filled my mind. I had no room to really write. Because in many ways, as hard as writing is, there's a sense of play there. It's a very, very playful thing to do. You're moving words around. You're trying to find, you know, you're lost in it. And if you're lost in something else, there's no more room. So I think that's something I would definitely say up front. For me, I think we're in a pretty good situation. Where we are in Toronto has been fairly quiet. We haven't had any family issues really so far. A few small ones, but nothing catastrophic. You know, both my girlfriend and I are okay.
That's
you know, financially, all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
And so what I found was, okay, given that I'm in that state, actually, I'm in a position where I can create. And but what I found was I didn't want to focus on finishing the last part of my previous series, the Less Than the Sum series about the knee and everything, about sort of self-imposed isolation or injury and trauma-imposed isolation, because that was not about connecting and reaching out into the world. It was about sort of, you know, when you're on the retreat. And I found that very difficult to write about. So all of a sudden, I was like, well, okay, I don't want to write about that, but I want to even more create something and be connecting with the community, because I've been through this before. I know what it is to kind of be isolated, and I know what it is to want to connect, and I want to do that through the art form I'm best at. And so I think that's why I started writing, just about literally what was happening to us in COVID right now, because I knew that everyone was going through it, you know, and that everyone was having these conversations in March where their parents were like, I'm just going to go out, it'll be fine. And you're like, stay home, mom. You're 65, you know, whatever it is. And everyone was trying to go to the grocery store and it was shut down, and really excited if they found an empty one. Everyone was having trouble, you know, ordering food. Everybody was going on that COVID date where, you know, they couldn't do any, like the shops were closed down. You know, this was happening to so many people. And even the funniest one was my dad was growing this tomato garden.
Yeah, that was a good story.
Thank you. And I was asking around, I was like, is everybody else growing? Everybody was growing tomato gardens. So, you know, COVID garden, like we're all sort of, you know, and, you know, and the stories are not trying to be pandering. They're not trying to suggest that, you know, this isn't a very, very difficult time. And they're also not trying to paint it with a rosy colored glasses, but there is trying to get a sense of the important stuff, you know, the family, the art that we can see, the little victories that we have, just kind of surviving and connecting with the world. You know, I think it's important that that is emphasized. You know, I sort of, one of my mantras in writing is reads funny, sit sad. And so I like the stories to have this sense of, as you go through it, it is not depressing. But afterwards, you do have this sort of feeling, you know, that kind of purple heart feeling where you're like, I'm not sad and I'm not happy. I'm okay. I'm aware of what's happening and I had an experience. That kind of feeling. It's a very mixed thing, which I think is sort of what we're all kind of going through. So I think that was what kind of inspired me to write about the now, because I could do it and I also felt that everyone was going through it, so it was a good way to connect.
That's, yeah, I really like what you just said about the reads funny, sits sad. I mean, that's the feeling I got after listening to a lot of your stories. I want to ask you, do you ever, like, have you written anything in novel form or anything longer, or is it mainly stories? Because I actually really admire story writers. That's not something that I feel very comfortable with. Most of the time, it takes me a while to get going, and that's why I tend to gravitate when I write toward longer pieces. But I really admire somebody who can write a really good story, because a story is, you know, it's short and it says a lot in a very short period of time. Do you ever like write anything longer, or do you feel very comfortable with that story form?
I like this form right now for sure. I've been more and more comfortable with this idea of a style that implies more than it says, and I've really been enjoying that part of it. I think that when I was maybe in my early 20s, I was trying more towards the novelistic form, which I, you know, greatly, greatly respect. And, you know, that's pretty much all I read for a really long time. And I might give it a shot again, but I just feel, for me, to put it another way, I don't know how much control I have over the choices I make about what's good when I write. You know, yeah. I think, you know, you have so much, you know, you have this sort of small amount in your hand that you can really use as a creative person. And I know I'm using all of it. So I hope I have a hidden box somewhere with, you're also a novel writer and you can do epic poems. It's all there, right? Because what I'm seeing here is this little, you know, these grains of sand of like, you have got 10 pages in you. It's going to be great. But it's 10 pages, and then it'll take a month. You're going to get 2 pages after that, you know? So there is this element of, I don't know how much choice I really have in that. When I try to force it and write differently, my bad habits come back and I notice people are not as interested in, you know, what I'm writing. So it may be that the style's chosen me. I do like it. I think it's very worthwhile. I really respect people that can do it. But I'm, once this project is finished, these stories are done and it's in a bit of a package, it will be interesting to see, what's out of my system. If, you know, that box opens and all of a sudden a great script comes out or a play comes out or, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I'm waiting. It feels out of my control a little bit. That's probably just, you know, me being evasive.
No, that's great. I noticed that you had another story published in it was the Stories We Don't Tell anthology. And first of all, congratulations. I think you mentioned that earlier in this interview, that kind of came out of the readings that you were doing. But can you talk a little more about that? Like how that anthology came about and how your story was included in it?
Yeah, that was a really interesting, is a really interesting group. I say hello to Paul Dorr and Stefan Hossetter. They run it. I just met them from a Facebook group. It was really funny. Just showed up and they were surprised. They're like, oh, hey, how's it going? They run this regular storytelling show, and they also run a writing group that goes along with it. They had about 5 years of material, and they picked sort of the top stories from that they liked and put it in this book. So I was more than happy to do it. I thought it was a really great project. And it was interesting that I know there was a disagreement among them there's a third person involved in the project as well, who about what story to put in. I think they wanted to put in my current material, which is about my knee and everything. But the story that ended up going in is called The Third Guitarist, and it's very self-contained. It's about my brother begrudgingly teaching me how to play guitar when I'm 19, because I kind of wanted to meet girls at university. Yeah. And him telling me directly, you know, there are three kinds of guitarists, and the first one can't play, thinks he can, no one likes that guy. The second one can play, but he can't play anything that anybody wants to hear at the party. He doesn't meet anyone. The third one just loves the guitar, and he can play everything.
Yeah.
And guess what? That guy has a girlfriend, you know? And so it was this message of, if you're going to use this art form as a means to an end, you will fail. If you love the art form for what it is, and you will just have a better life, period.
Yeah.
And that will probably be attracted to people. And then it goes into me studying the guitar more intensely. And I meet this, I have this class with this Parisian guitarist who was very prominent at the time. And he says, you're too boring as a person to play the piece that you want to play. And he wasn't wrong. He was like, this is a Cuban dance piece. Have you ever danced this kind of dance? Have you ever been to Florida or Cuba or even Miami? Have you ever been deeply in love? Like, your hands are fine, but if you don't live your life, if you don't love your life, you know, and really yeah. participate in it, the soul of this music is not going to be there. So it was that kind of story. I really like it. It's very different from some of my work now. And I think they felt the same way. It was self-contained, and they put it in the book. I think it's also lighter. That book is very much about, as the name says, stories people don't normally tell, very difficult ones, you know, about trauma and family and oppressive parts of society, and very brave people coming out to tell those truths. And I just happened to sneak in there and be the comic relief, I think, a little bit, or just the lighter side of the stories we don't tell about being embarrassed, you know? So that was it. And one thing I would say about that experience is you never know where things are going to go. And it's very important to just do the very best you can wherever you are. You know, this was a Facebook group. I didn't know what their deal was. But I tried to write the best story I possibly could. And it was my first publication. If I had come to it with a lot of ego and pride, I said, this isn't good enough for me. I don't know what this is. Any of that kind of stuff. I would not be doing any of the stuff I am doing now. They really gave me a platform to get confident about my writing and gave me a way of deciding what kind of writer I wanted to be, you know, at the age I am now. So I would really recommend that. Look for things, look for communities, and when you find an opportunity, just do the absolute best you can. Don't hold back, and you know, just really commit to it.
That's great. You've mentioned quite a bit about social media, and social media has been fantastic for me too. Like, once I got more comfortable with Twitter, I've met a lot of great writers, including you. It's just opened so many possibilities. I'm using Instagram more. I just recently, within the last few months, I started using Instagram. For some reason, I never used it before. And Facebook, you know, I've been using for years. I don't really use it as much as Twitter. I like Twitter a lot more. But why do you think social media is so important for a writer? And how could a writer who's maybe not comfortable with social media or doesn't think that they need it, what are some things they can do to maybe start using it and becoming more comfortable with it? Because it is a little overwhelming at first. I had a Twitter account for a few years before I really felt comfortable trying to expand on it.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I do want to say is I do not want to come across as an expert but from my own, from what I can see, I'm going to steal a quote from an expert that I did really like what you had to say, and I'll send you her, I can't remember her name right now, but I'll send it to you and you can maybe put it in the notes to credit her properly. And she wrote a book about how to be published, how to stay published, I think was the name of it. And basically what she said was, you know, write the best possible book you can, live an interesting life as best you possibly can, and don't get too wrapped up in the numbers on any social media. Don't get too wrapped up in the math. And I would extend that and say, don't get too wrapped up in the promotional idea. I think, you know, old is new again. I think the idea of the power of a small supportive community cannot be understated. So, you know, try to find the 30 or 40 people that you can interact with regularly, that you like their work, that are sort of maybe at the same level, that you can start trying things and be as creative as you can with it. And so what that means for me is if you're just sort of, you know, doing it, whatever social media thing you're doing, and there are, again, people who know how to go viral and people who know to get tens of thousands of people, I'm not really, you know, they'll be fine. And if you're one of them, you're going to be fine, right? Like if you're on TikTok and you're a great dancer, I'm not worried about you. But for, you know, the writer who is a good writer or really loves the art form and is sort of worried about, like, I don't have thousands of followers, whatever, I think to focus on developing a small, supportive, dedicated community, reach out to them, make stuff, you know, I made stop motion videos from sculptures that of me that my girlfriend made that were of, you know, really silly. You know, I think the first one had me, which is Clay John, it's a clay version of me,
yeah,
falling in love with a Scandal perfume bottle to the tune of Anna Green Gables, but it was the Farsi overdub of Anna Green Gables with Careless Whisper played underneath it.
Oh, wow.
Like, you couldn't, right? You couldn't get more, you know. And you know, I had 20 followers, and people would say, I'm bored. What do you got? And I would send them this video. this is what you got. You know? And I would put work, that kind of work into it. I would do on Instagram, I would do these collage-like cartoons with my picture of me when I'm 5 and my childhood wiener dog, and we would go on mystery adventures that would always go terrible. And I would start putting in some of my Instagram followers, and I'd say, you want to be in this? Send me a picture. And I'd cut a picture of them, and they become a character, you know, and I would say, basically saying, hey, you're part of this, you know, and what do you want to do? Or that, how do you want to, you know, collaborate in this creative community? It's the same with, you know, the idea of writing poetry or setting up a tweet that other people can participate in. It's just seeing this thing as a community that you can build up, and it doesn't have to be thousands of people. The algorithm might need thousands of people, and there are ways to game that, and I'll leave that to Google for people to figure that out. But once you have gamed it successfully, remember that the whole point is you can have 10,000 followers by doing follow back and all that kind of stuff, but getting them to read your book and to care about you and all and care about your work is a whole different thing. So once that's just the beginning, and building up this community, I think, is a slow, steady process. And if you get 40 to 50 real fans, by which I mean people that would sign up to your newsletter or come to an event you hold or read your book, it's a big deal. You can do a lot with 50 people, you know? And once you get that kind of thing, a little momentum builds, and other people who may be interested and may be legitimately where you want to be will start to take notice. And that's what I'm sort of feeling now, that some writers I really respect are following me. We're having conversations. Some publishers that I really respect are doing the same kind of thing. We're talking.
Yeah. You know?
I have something to do on Wednesday at 9 p.m. Actually, I have another thing to do, which is dinner, so I will have to leave soon.
That's fine.
But
I thought you ate already. I saw a picture on Instagram. That looked really good.
That's why I gotta go. It was made and now it's ready. So it's probably, I said it was an hour. But I think, you know, the moral of the story is be aware that, you know, think of it as a small community, small salon, and you'll get, I think, a more reliable experience, and one that I think is just more enjoyable. And again, if you are a person that can go viral, and you send me an email, let me know what's going on, you'll be fine. But to everybody else, there is this other thing I think you can do, and a way to think about it that I think will be helpful as you write the best book you can, as you try to still keep living your life. And if you do that, then you can start sending that out. This is a support for good work, essentially.
That's great. And I hope, if it hasn't already, that video of you with the kangaroo, that goes viral.
That should be my viral dance. If anyone wants to see that, you can come to my Twitter account, JohnAaronSandler.com. Yes, I am dancing with oranges and a kangaroo. You know what? I'm happy to leave it at that. That's a great ending right there.
Does that work for you? I think so. Yeah, the kangaroo dance video is just amazing. John Aaron, I want to thank you so much. It's been really great knowing you through Twitter and interacting with you. And if there's anything else you want to plug or whatnot, this has been, you've said so many interesting things that I know my listeners will get a lot out of. So I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me.
Oh, my pleasure. This was great. Thank you. I'm really looking forward to the podcast. My website is the one-stop shop. So if you're linking to it, you know, JohnAaronSandler.com. From there, there's a buy me a coffee. If you like what I do, feel free to spend $3 or less, I guess, if it's American. and you can buy me a coffee. There's an Instagram, John Aaron Sandler. There's a Twitter, John Aaron Sandler. I make it pretty easy to find me. I'm the first hit on Google when you do J-O-N Aaron Sandler. So that's great. And coming up, we're going to have a little store, John and H. We'll have lots of really exciting things to see and do. So yeah, just stay tuned and it'll all come through the website. The last thing I'd say is, if you do go to my website and you want to sign up for the newsletter, that helps me tremendously. So please, the newsletter's at the bottom of every page, and I just love that. And that keeps everybody in touch.
That's great. Well, thanks again. It's been really wonderful talking to you. I really enjoy, I enjoy your stuff. I mean, your website, I just thought was fantastic. You're so talented in so many ways. I think that's really fantastic. So it's been
much.
A real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Once again, I want to thank my guest, John Aaron Sandler, for taking the time to talk to me. And I also want to thank all of you listeners for all of your support. I am so grateful for all the support, retweets, and kind words I receive from you. And if you'd like to drop me a line, please, please email me at marissadelefarfalle@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter at marissad13, or you can find me on Instagram at marissadf13. And also, I'd really appreciate it if you could take a moment to rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts, as it'll help a lot more people find out about this show. Until next time, please stay safe and peace out.
This podcast has been brought to you by Anchor, which is the easiest way to make a podcast. Go to anchor.fm for more info.